Good afternoon. May it please the court, Judge Webb, Judge Richmond, and Judge Rothenberg, also Mr. Coles, Ms. Moran, and Ms. Rudberg. My name is Thomas J. Thompson. My attorney registration number is 5941. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Cheryl Hyam, and she is present in the courtroom with her husband, Alan. Not until sometime after December 19, 2011, did it become apparent that the fundamental difference in this case between the approach between the plaintiff and the defendant was different. On December 19, the approach by the defendant, by the plaintiff, was that the disclosures were meant to be a complete disclosure regarding the identity of the experts and their curriculum vitaes, their fee schedules, and their testimonial history. However, there was a timely motion filed under Rule 6, which would have sufficed, requesting an opportunity to go ahead and supplement not only the opinions or the reports from those experts, but also supplemental experts, which I deemed a desire to want to possibly name 3 days later, which I did. The defendant's position became after that, but never fully told to me before that, that they wanted the entire disclosure of the experts on that date.
Why would it have been incumbent on the defendant to tell you that when the rule requires it?
Understand, Your Honor. Based on conversations which I had had with Mr. Rendleman, based on what I was proceeding and proceeding on as to what I believed would be the procedure that would be followed, and this was again, not by the rules, this is what I had done with Mr. Hubbard many times in the past, his associate Mr. Jones. Ultimately, I didn't know Ms. Rutberg was going to be in the case, but I had done the same thing with her. We had an unwritten situation in our cases where we deposed both the plaintiff and the defendant, and then we disclosed experts. Now, call that custom, habit, routine, call that just our habit, but that's exactly what the way that I was proceeding on. And that's what I discussed with Mr. Rendleman on October 7. That's what I discussed with him on December 1. That's what I said in my confidential settlement memorandum to Ms. Ortner on December 7, which I provided a complete copy to opposing counsel. So I understand the rules. That's not the problem, Your Honor. And what I'm trying to say is after the death of Mr. Hubbard, in which he and I would have proceeded in a different fashion, I was proceeding in one manner based on what I had always done. Obviously, that perception was not shared by Mr. Rendleman, or at least it was never conveyed to me. So, yes, Your Honor, it was required by the rules, and what I did was, is I did disclose experts, and I did have the additional experts that just hadn't gotten back to me, but they did 2 days later, and I endorsed them 3 days later. And then what I proceeded to do by the time of the hearing was to proceed forward with three experts, Drs. Ratner, Dr. Miller, and Dr. Blanchard. Now, going forward to the hearing that transpired, it was a status hearing. That's what it was billed for. And it ended up being a four-hour evidentiary hearing. And after 4 hours, the magistrate entered a ruling striking my timely motion to supplement my opinions or with written reports or summaries by my experts, and also striking my request that I be allowed to endorse the three additional experts, which were timely disclosed on December 22.
Well, you didn't tender any reports for the supplemental experts either, did you?
No, I did not. And I was the disclosures on the 19th and the 22nd are identical, Judge. So there's no difference between them. And yes, you're absolutely right. Many things were discussed during that hearing, which I...
Could I just interrupt and ask some factual questions, if I might? I'll ask them to your opponent as well. Is there a consent form in the record?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
In other words, when your client had this procedure done, it's a medical procedure.
Yes, ma'am.
Was there any mention of this possibility that she could end up with nerve damage? Is this a common side effect?
That's a two-point question, Your Honor. First of all, there was a consent form, and yes, it was signed. And these issues are usually litigated quite extensively in these types of cases. Temporary numbness or temporary healing type numbness is expected. Total anesthesia or total paresthesia, or in this case, dysesthesia, which is a burning, searing pain, which is unrelenting and has never ended, is generally, in my opinion, not encompassed in the consent form. And we have Lisio versus Lisio. Lisio's Colorado case, which basically says you don't necessarily consent to negligence by merely signing the consent
form. I understand that. I'm not driving at the consent form. I'm driving at what the doctor knew. The patient called her after she was feeling pain.
Correct.
She said, "I hurt. Here's how." So the doctor was on notice that the patient hurt?
The doctor was on notice during the procedure because she took an intraoperative x-ray and saw that the implant was in the canal, re-anesthetized the patient, opened again and backed the implant out.
Did she do the entire procedure in one day, the insert and then the tooth in?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor. I apologize.
That's all right. And then when patient called the doctor and said, "I hurt," the doctor saw her again?
Absolutely.
So the doctor was aware of what her complaint was?
Absolutely. Within 2 days and then within a 7-day follow-up appointment.
Was there anything other than the expert saying this was wrong? Were there any surprises to the defendant about what happened here?
My contention is no for this reason, Your Honor. I did initial disclosures on May 13, 2011. And on May 13, 2011, I supplied approximately 165 pages of medical records.
So she had all the medical records, and then were your doctor's experts' records in there? What did she, in other words, I'm trying to figure out what she knew.
So what she knew was Dr. Aragon had a three-dimensional ICAT in his records, which showed the implant squarely into the canal. Then he had an intraoperative photo taken November 24, 2009, which is in Exhibit 14 to the addendum, which shows the implant squarely depressing the inferior alveolar nerve, much like a bow and arrow. Those were all supplied May 13, 2011 to the defendant.
What about the mediation? What did the defendant know as a result of the mediation?
As a result of the mediation, my habit and custom is to supply not only the confidential settlement statement, but all medical records. And they were yellow highlighted. So this was on December 7, 2011. Not only were all the records which had been previously disclosed, redisclosed, but also additional records were provided from a Dr. Brewer, who had just in 2011, June, late June, started treating the patient with ganglion shots in an effort to try and alleviate the excruciating pain.
Right, and I'll ask your opponent this too, but what is the prejudice, the surprise
in
that they're
opinion,
alleging that created this kind of a sanction?
In my opinion, none.
What was their purported prejudice, as you understand it?
Well,
forget the sword of Damocles.
Yes. So the supposition is that there would not be proper time to do Shrek motions, etc., etc., etc. My argument to that is the court could have fashioned an argument by saying, we're going to expedite deadlines, we're going to, Mr. Thompson, you're going to disclose these experts' reports, whether you have them or not, within 7 days, or face sanction of dismissal. Counsel, you're going to counter with whatever, and if a prejudice does arise, or a problem arises, come back and talk to me.
Were attorney's fees discussed as a sanction?
Not at all. No sanctions were discussed at all, Your Honor, respectfully, other than dismissal.
Thank you.
As long as you opened it, you said that it wasn't no secret that she was having this pain, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
The defendant knew as well. Did Dr. Aragon's medical records indicate not only that he was treating for this condition, but that it was his opinion that the condition resulted from negligence on the part of Dr. Lustig?
Dr. Aragon is very, very careful. He treats those injuries which no one else will treat. He never goes so far as to render opinions on standard of care.
So there was
always on causation, and the reports were full of his detailed reports and analysis, and the diagnosis was traumatic neuropathy as a result of the placement of the implant.
Right.
He's not saying whether the implant was placed improperly or not, but he shows a photograph with it square right into the middle of the inferior alveolar nerve.
Right, but the doctor knew that. She
yes.
tried to correct it. He said the day after, I don't know the time. My point is, was there anything in these medical records, the 100 and something pages that you produced, that indicated somebody's opinion that this F is negligence because of A, B, or C?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. They were damages and causation, to be fair.
It was in the complaint, but not in the documents?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Well, what came up with the mediation?
Well, typical to most mediations, the parties met jointly, then the parties met separately.
But to follow up on Judge Richman's question, what were they told about the standard of care at the mediation? What you were going to prove? If anything.
It was not discussed, Your Honor. It was not discussed.
It was just a settlement to see if you could come to terms?
Correct.
Was the doctor given, the defendant given an opportunity to fix this?
She treated the patient for an additional 6 months with the patient asking that something be done. Nothing was done. She finally recommended that she go to Chicago to see a doctor, which my client thought unusual. Did some internet research and found Dr. Aragon in Inverness in South Denver, who is a recognized world-known specialist in this area. I only have 8 minutes left. I want to reserve some time for amicus, if I may, please. Thank you.
Well, I do want to ask you one more question.
Certainly.
I'm sorry. You did serve expert reports for Drs. Ratner and Dr. Miller.
And Dr. Blanchard, as a summary.
In January.
Yes.
In two of those reports, Ratner and Miller say they discussed their opinions with you in December of 2011. Did they discuss those opinions with you prior to filing the expert designations on December 19th?
In general, yes, Your Honor, because they gave me their CVs, their fee schedules, and their testimonials to say that they would agree to act as an expert in this case.
Did they discuss with you, in a sense, the substance of what was in those reports that you later filed?
The outline substance of what's in those reports was discussed. Now, obviously, they did, but Drs. Miller and Drs. Ratner did a great job of filling in the bare bones outline, but the thrust of what was in their opinions was discussed, as well as with Dr. Blanchard.
So was there anything that prevented you from disclosing those opinions when you filed the designations on December 19th?
Each of these doctors had not testified extensively. In a couple of cases, one or two only. They were very hesitant to speak about another professional and say something about another professional. They really wanted to know, and it's in my brief, what was she thinking? What was going on? What did she say to the doctor? What did she say to the patient? What was going on? They wanted to hear from the defendant what her testimony would be before they expressed final opinions. It was a matter of professional courtesy.
So does does that mean you could have insisted that they provide the reports by December 19th?
I probably could have. When you're dealing with an expert, it's kind of like a two-way street. You ask and they'll say, this is what I would like to do, is that okay? So I you can't force them to do something, but I probably could have.
Thank you.
I only have 6 minutes left. May I reserve some for amicus, please?
I understand that comes out of your time.
I know. Thank you.
Sir, I'm going to wait for rebuttal.
May it please this court, my name is Matt Coles, and I thank the court for permitting me to appear pro hoc vice. My state bar number from the state of Georgia is 178020. I appear today on behalf of the appellee, Dr. Bluestein, who is also in the courtroom. And on her behalf, I urge this court to affirm the lower court's decisions. Judge, should I immediately address the question?
Yes, welcome to Colorado. And please talk about the prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. In a case like this, it's important for this court to understand that the doctor had, if you will, three phases of treatment with this patient. The first was the pre-surgical, then of course the surgical, and then the post-surgical. What that means is there is a wide variety of allegations that can and are made against doctors. Sometimes the doctor is accused of not properly discussing the surgery with the patient beforehand and doing everything else appropriately. Sometimes the doctor is accused of doing something inappropriately during the procedure and doing everything else appropriately. And sometimes the doctor is accused of doing everything appropriately until after the procedure when a complaint is brought to her attention and then not acting appropriately. It is for that reason we submit that there was extreme prejudice, because the defense did not know this close to trial what they were going to have to defend against. Furthermore, they did not know what type of experts necessarily should they bring to bear to best defend their client. And I found it interesting that this analysis of what was the harm has been addressed in several opinions, and if I can briefly address the Trattler opinion, in that opinion, as this court is probably well aware, the Supreme Court was dealing with a failure to identify all of the testimonial history. And the Supreme Court noted that while important to lawyers to cross-examine an expert, is not central to the case, is what the Supreme Court said.
And getting away from the law and just looking at the facts, if we may, because these cases are fact-driven. She knew that she had a patient who had called her to complain of pain. She had seen the patient. She's an expert. She saw the nerve damage. She sent her on her way. I don't understand what she didn't know that you couldn't have found out in the 5 months before trial was set for.
What was not known, Your Honor?
Correct.
What was not known was, will the doctor be accused of doing something inappropriately in the build-up to the surgery? Will she be accused of doing something inappropriately during the procedure? For example, in the field of oral and maxillofacial surgery of late, there has been a controversy over whether CBCT, cone beam CT scans, are required. And the experts that were late disclosed, indeed some of them, addressed that issue. This to me is a perfect illustration of the prejudice. Once the defense is put on notice that they will have to deal with that issue among many others, they might go out and find who they consider to be the preeminent scholar on CBCT and whether or not it is the standard of care. But they're not going to know that until the experts are disclosed, and more importantly, until the substantive opinions of the experts are disclosed.
Most of the cases involve the eve of trial. Here you have 3 or 4 months to go. Why would the magistrate pull the trigger that far in advance and not look for intermediate sanctions that the Supreme Court has talked about?
Your Honor, we believe that the magistrate did very, very carefully consider other alternatives.
What page of the transcript would show that?
Specifically, Your Honor, let me find that, please. I believe it is at page 409, but let me confirm that.
Thank you.
And as I'm looking for that, as this court is well aware, the magistrate has considerable discretion as to whether or not she will impose a particular consequence or not. At page 411, that's the transcript page 90, the magistrate discussed a continuance and what effect that would have on the parties. The magistrate discussed a continuance and whether that would impact the orderly business of the court. And specifically, the magistrate discussed the fact that if the late disclosed expert opinions were permitted, the defense would be put at a distinct disadvantage because they would not have adequate time to challenge those experts, if that was appropriate. They would not have adequate time to determine the best rebuttal expert to gather, and that would be appropriate in every case. And the court pointed out that given the late disclosure, the trial judge, the district judge, would not be given the opportunity to enter a trial management order that would be to the benefit of all the litigants and certainly the state.
What evidence of willfulness is in the record? The latest discussion by our Supreme Court is Warden versus Medical Center, and both of you have done a superb job on the briefs, so there's no question you agree on the law, but where is the showing of bad faith that is required under Todd?
Your Honor, the answer to the question is at page 345, that is transcript 24, the magistrate specifically asked plaintiff's counsel, help me out here, basically, she said. That's my language, not hers, but she said, tell me what happened in this case from May until August 30, when former defense counsel passed away. The magistrate gave every opportunity, and the answer in the record was, quote, nothing.
So we have negligence, but where is the evidence of bad faith?
Your Honor, in this, and it's been alluded to earlier, when the experts were disclosed on January 3rd and their substantive opinions were provided, each and every expert said, I discussed these opinions with plaintiff's counsel before my name was given as an expert. We know their names were given as experts on December 19, the deadline. These counsel, these doctors have confirmed knowledge on the part of plaintiff's counsel, and we're dealing with very experienced plaintiff's counsel who knew the rule. We are left with no other conclusion based on this record than that the plaintiff's counsel had in his possession at least some, if not all, of the detailed substantive opinions before December 19 and opted not to share them. I think it's also important for this court to note that both the magistrate and the district court judge took time to mention and reject the argument by plaintiff that this was really the fault of the defense. And indeed, that argument has been brought before this honorable court in several ways. The amicus brief, for example, refers to defense counsel as engaging in, quote, deplorable conduct, close quote. The magistrate and the district court judge concluded to the contrary. They concluded that such an argument was disingenuous, was inaccurate, and I would submit, Your Honor, that that was part of the background that the magistrate had to consider, and she properly considered that background in determining bad faith.
Did she make a finding of bad faith anywhere in the transcript?
Your Honor, I do not believe she specifically used the words, I find this is bad faith.
Or willfulness.
She did find, Your Honor, I believe, she said there is a complete, total lack of substantial justification. Her language on that was very, very clear. It should also be noted, Your Honor, that while it is the plaintiff's burden to establish substantial justification or harmlessness, and the appellate decisions from this court have made it clear that the lower courts have wide discretion, those lower courts, the magistrate in particular, presided over a four-hour hearing. The magistrate gave both sides, plaintiff in particular, ample opportunity to explain what had happened. The magistrate spent a long time carefully analyzing these facts. And at the end of that, the magistrate concluded there is, it's not even close, there is absolutely no substantial justification. And she added, plaintiff's counsel has engaged in a disingenuous argument. And I would also point out on the bad faith or the willfulness issue, I want to touch on another expert, the economist, who's really not involved here, but the magistrate's findings with regard to the economist are very important. The only explanation offered as to why the substantive opinions were not given timely was that the defendant was not produced for a deposition. The magistrate, very experienced, commented, well, you don't need the defense deposition for the economist, and yet you didn't produce any opinions from the economist. That, Your Honor, we believe suggests willfulness, if not bad faith. Furthermore, once the opinions were given by all of the experts, Not a single expert said, I have to hedge my bets because I haven't reviewed the deposition.
Did you depose them? How do you know? How do you support that in the record, what you just said?
Your Honor, in the offer of proof that was filed on January 30, that they were not deposed.
I see, the one who, the stricken offer of proof?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And that offer of proof included detailed substantive opinions from the experts, and on its face, it confirms that there was no reason those opinions could not have been provided on December 19. On its face, it also confirms that there was absolutely no necessity to take the defendant's deposition before those opinions were offered. All of that, we submit, suggests willfulness, if not bad faith.
What prevented you from deposing the plaintiff's experts?
Well, first, Your Honor, they were not identified until December 19th.
Right.
You mean after they were identified?
Right, between December 19th and, say, March, before the trial date, what would have prevented... In other words, I'm thinking, when the magistrate looked at this, there were other possibilities, attorney's fees, ordering immediate depositions of the physicians. Why wasn't that considered?
Your Honor, the appellate courts have specifically noted that it is not an answer to non-disclosure to say all you have to do is go take the deposition and you'll get all this information. That's point one I would ask this court to please consider.
Excuse me. What case would you direct us to for that, please?
May I?
Sure.
My co-counsel already gave me the case, and I think she'll find the citation, and Judge Webb will give that to you. But in this opinion that we will give you, the court specifically said it's not an answer. Don't come before us and say no harm because they can take the deposition. The point, too, I was about to make, one of the purposes of Rule 26 is, and this has been commented on by the appellate courts, is to give the defense the opportunity to say, we don't need to take these depositions. We don't need to incur the expense of taking these depositions. I have been involved in cases where you read the substance of the expert's opinion, and trial lawyers know this, you sort of laugh to yourself and say, I hope they bring this person into the courtroom.
Why educate them?
Exactly. But the purpose of Rule 26 is to afford, one of the purposes is to afford the opposing party the right to calmly sit in your office, discuss with your client, do we want to take this expert's deposition?
Well, following up on Judge Webb's question, there's a considerable body of law in Colorado that also talks about the policy of trying cases on the merits and not pulling the plug on plaintiffs if there are other reasonable sanctions. I'm sure you're familiar, you've cited them in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what is the case in response to Judge Webb?
There are two. It's Svedinson versus Robinson.
Say again, please.
I'll spell Svendsen versus Robinson, 94 Pacific 3rd, 1204. And Carlson versus Ferris, 58 P 3rd, 1055. And I will note that those opinions, I believe, have been criticized by the Supreme Court, but not for that point. The point is very clear that going to take the deposition is not a remedy.
For non-disclosure of an expert's substantive opinion.
Yes.
And
I know this panel is well aware of the language, but I think it bears just one specific citation to Rule 26. This is the language. The expert's disclosure shall be accompanied by a written report. The report or summary shall contain a complete statement of all opinions to be expressed and the basis and reasons therefore. Your Honors, in this case, the information that was not disclosed is the very essence of a professional malpractice case. Now, it is true that for two of the experts, standard of care experts, the names were provided on December 19. But I dare say you ask 100 trial lawyers this question, which would you rather have, the name, the CV, what they charge, or their substantive opinions. And 99 out of 100 are going to tell you, I want their substantive opinions.
True, but nothing prevented you from deposing those two individuals sometime after December 19th, correct?
I believe that is accurate, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't the continuance have solved all the issues of prejudice that you outlined?
In one sense, I would have to acknowledge it would have solved the non-disclosure and the time constraints, but it would have run contrary to the clear admonition from the Supreme Court in the Todd case. And I'm specifically referencing the court's language wherein the court said, and this is a quote, continuance of scheduled trials should be limited to circumstances in which unforeseen and exceptional circumstances require diligent attorneys to request an adjournment. The Supreme Court went on to say, specifically, citing older law before Rule 26 was in force, and before Rule 26 was in force, it was apparently very common to say, there's no harm, we'll continue the trial. The Supreme Court in the Todd case said, no more. These are new rules. Of course, they said this. They said that back in 1999. They're no longer new rules now. But the Supreme Court in the Todd case specifically warned against continuing a trial to take care of a non-disclosure. And there are many policy reasons for that, which the magistrate carefully considered. One of those, the sword of Damocles hanging over the defendant's head. A second, the prejudgment interest that continues to grow and grow and grow. And in these economic days, that interest is a very significant factor.
But that could have been handled by assessing the attorney fees, correct?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has ruled that a trial court cannot, as a condition of a continuance, automatically just say, I'm stopping the prejudgment interest.
No, he can't stop it or she can't stop it, but she can say to the lawyer, either lawyer, this is your fault, I'm assessing the lawyer's fees. But let me just follow up with one other body of law that I'm familiar with, and I'm sure you are, because you've cited so many cases. That is the principle in Colorado that the client should not be punished for the recalcitrance of the lawyer. We have many cases that were thrown out where the client didn't show up for deposition and so on. The client acted improperly. We have no such allegations here. Why should the client pay for the negligence, if any, of the lawyer when there's another remedy, which is to assess fees against the lawyer?
Your Honor, it is an unfortunate consequence of the practice of law that clients are, on occasion, in some way, they suffer as a result of what their attorneys do. And for instance, if a statute of limitations is missed, it is no answer to say, it's not the client's fault, so we're going to let that go. There are clear rules, and the clear rules exist for a purpose. Those clear rules were put in place, presumably after a vast amount of study, by the Supreme Court of Colorado, and they were put in place for very specific reasons. And there's been a body of law that has developed, and that body of law has made it clear, don't preclude evidence unless there's no substantial justification, which there was not in this case. It's not harmless. It was not in this case. It's important and really prejudices the defendant because they didn't get it in a timely fashion. All of that happened. And even then, the magistrate or the district court judge is not supposed to preclude evidence unless they consider things like a continuance. In this case,
and willfulness.
And willfulness, yes, Your Honor. In this case, although I would, going all the way back to an earlier question Your Honor asked me in 23 seconds, and that is that I believe under the new rules, the bad faith element is no longer nearly enshrined with the importance that it was. And in the Todd case, the Supreme Court noted that. The Supreme Court noted that bad faith is no longer the touchstone that must be touched in order to preclude. The magistrate's decision in this case was thoughtful, and we ask that this court please affirm that order. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. May it please the court, Nelson Boyle, 39525, appearing for Amicus Curiae CTLA, the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. The decision to strike the plaintiff's expert witnesses should have been guided by consideration and adherence to the precedent that rejects litigation ending sanctions, except on extreme circumstances where no other option exists. Judge Rothenberg, I think you touched on a point that I was going to touch on, which was that the sanctions should be commensurate with the actual prejudice, and that there's significant precedent that shows that in cases like in Cook v. Fernandez Rocha, where the disclosure goes even close to the eve of trial, there may not be harm, or it may be harmless.
Isn't Cook distinguishable because there the court made, you know, no findings of either prejudice or lack of substantial justification, whereas here, after a four-hour hearing, the magistrate made extensive findings on both?
I think I was just looking up Cook when the discussion was going on, and I believe that in the opinion from the Supreme Court, it says that the court found that the plaintiff's lawyer didn't address why they couldn't do it, but I think you're right, they didn't make clear findings of harmlessness, so it was reversed to go back to the trial court for that purpose.
And here the plaintiff had ample opportunity to explain justification.
That's correct, Your Honor. Here, there was a request for a deposition on December 1st that was completely ignored until January, after, or just before the hearing took place on January 10th. On January 5th, they finally responded to the request for the deposition. If they had, in their brief, they defendant Bluestein says that, you know, it's Christmas time or it's holidays and there's it's hard to get people, but they never said that to plaintiff's counsel in any letter or email or response that's responsive to the December 1st request, or the December 23rd email saying, you know, hey, I'm following up on my December 1st request. They don't respond for a full month. So defendant in causing this delay was at least partially responsible. I mean, if defendant really couldn't get a hold of their client, defense counsel couldn't get a hold of their client, or if they couldn't do something to get a deposition scheduled, they should have responded that way, but it's self-serving to look back and say that there was no way to get a deposition when they never notified the plaintiff, no, you're not going to be able to get a deposition, we checked with our client.
Both the magistrate and the district court rejected that explanation for not timely disclosing experts. Are you asking us to revisit that?
I guess, in a sense, yes. I didn't see when I read the transcript that they that looking at those facts and the argument really took place. But it's clear that there was no response from looking at the record. I guess you know, the concern of Amicus Curiae CTLA here is that the precedent would come from this case that punishes the parties and not counsel if there's a transgression by counsel.
Well, let's pursue that. What sanction against the plaintiff's counsel would make sense here?
Well, Your Honor, if I mean, assuming that the court in a given case, or in this case, finds that there's something that was done wrong by counsel, there's ways to do attorney fees. There's you know, sanctions with you know, paying the cost of depositions or the cost of, you know, if there's an expedited cost in getting the expert reports by the defendants done faster than, you know, having plaintiff's counsel pay those costs, which, you know, most counsel in a small practice, that would teach them a lesson that, you know, if they had to pay thousands of dollars to because they caused the trial time, you know, trial prep time to be crunched. But with 3 months to go, even at the time of the hearing, things could have been done to put this back on track. And to take away the plaintiff's day in court,
It kind of goes in the face of Schrattler and Todd and lots of other precedent that says, you know, that the parties should get their the merits of their claims heard in court. And I need to reserve the rest of the time for counsel. Thank you.
I have a minute 13. Judge Rothenberg, in response to one of your questions, Mr. Cole said the defendant didn't know what type of experts to retain or what type of allegations would be made. The records clearly established that in March of 2009, Dr. Bluestein referred Ms. Kayam to a Dr. Maloro in Chicago for consultation for this nerve pain. If you will look in the Record on Appeal, starting at CD 1082 through 1146, which is the defendant's bill of costs, Dr. Maloro was retained as an expert by Dr. Bluestein way in advance of any disclosure. So Dr. Maloro is essentially known on board since before my client ever got to Dr. Aragon. Second point, each one of those opinions by those doctors that I disclosed said they reserved the right to amend their opinions after having heard the depositions of the opposing side, the defendant. I just had a case on April 15 where the defendant's deposition was finally taken and it changed the opinions of my experts and they were willing to admit it. Nobody's seen anything in the records that really disclosed that. Finally, in response to, I think it was your question, Judge Richmond, my time is up. I'm sorry.
Do you want to
go ahead?
You may answer that.
I was trying to speak fast. You asked what would be the harm of a continuance, and Mr. Cole said it has to be highly unusual circumstances. 2020 hindsight, I mean, Dan Hubbard was a very close friend of mine, and for his tragic death on August 30, if I had had any brains, I would have asked for a continuance of this case. And it's not only just the legal aspects, it's the emotional aspects of having lost a very good friend. I think that alone would have been extraordinary circumstances which would have given rise appropriately for a continuance. Thank you very much. I would ask that you reverse the opinions of the Board of District Court. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel.